Well, good afternoon. This is Harry Brown, and this is The Money Show. So glad to be back with you for an hour of talking about money, the economy, finances, the economic principles that underlie investing, what to do with your money, anything related to the general subject of money. We'll even talk about such arcane things as the Federal Reserve System and how money is created if that comes up. And you're certainly invited to ask questions, make comments, criticisms, whatever, by calling 1-800-259-9231. And I'll be very glad to hear from you and hear what you have to say. And you can say it for everyone listening to the show. That's 1-800-259-9231. Or you can email me a question, comment. I will be glad to get those emails and perhaps read them on the air. The email address is Harry Brown. Pardon me. Let's start over again. The email address is question@harrybrown.org. question@harrybrown.org. And Brown has an E on the end. Well, this is the third broadcast in this new series of shows on the Genesis Network. In the first one, I gave what I call the 16 Golden Rules of Financial Safety. Those rules are simply an application of what we know about life in general to the specific world of investing. In other words, there's nothing earth-shaking in those rules. It's just simply that when investors, or let's say people in general, turn to investing, they seem to forget the rules that they follow in their business life or their personal life and think that they have entered a parallel universe in which the rules of life no longer apply. All the things that your mother taught you, don't trust strangers, don't take all your savings to the investment park. If everyone else were going to jump off a cliff, would you do that too? And so on down the line. All these rules that we live by, we seem to forget when we get into the investment world. So I went over those rules, and they are now available on my website. That is, you can go to my website and get a printed copy of the rules by just printing them out, or you can actually hear that first broadcast in my archives. Just go to harrybrown.org, and you'll find your way to either of the two, I'm sure. Last week, we talked then about the permanent portfolio, because one of the most important rules in the 16 Golden Rules is to recognize the difference between investing and speculating. And that was rule number 3. When you invest, you are accepting the return that is available to everyone else. In other words, you're not trying to beat the market. If you're going to invest in stocks, you just simply buy a mutual fund that emulates the S&P 500 index so that you get the same return that would be available to anybody else who was investing in stocks. When you invest in bonds, you don't try to figure out when the bond market is going to hit its low and buy at the low or sell at the top. You simply buy bonds and hold them and get the return that's available to everyone else. When you speculate, you are trying to beat the return that's available to everyone else, either through superior timing, through superior knowledge, inside information, better insights into the market, whatever it may be, you think you can do better than the average investor. In effect, you're saying you're smarter than other investors, and you can get a better return than they can by maybe following the right guru or exercising your own judgment and spending a lot of time on the computer figuring out when something is due to do something. Well, as I said last week, I talked about the permanent portfolio, which is my way of handling the investing part of the equation. I think that everyone should have a permanent portfolio. Not everyone will, of course, but I think everyone should, for the money that you cannot afford to lose. Now, in addition to that, if you want to try to beat the market, what you should do is set up a second portfolio, what I call a variable portfolio. The permanent portfolio is called permanent because it never changes. Once you set up, there's no reason to change it because you're not trying to beat the market. You're not trying to exercise a precise timing or anything of this sort. But then the second portfolio I call the variable portfolio, because you do vary it. You vary it according to what you think is hot right now. You may be 100% in cash. You may be 100% in stocks. You may be partly in this and partly in that. What you may be using it to follow the recommendations of your favorite newsletter writer. Whatever it may be, you do it. There are no basic rules for the variable portfolio. Anything goes, because it is funded with money you can afford to lose. Money that if you were to lose all of it, it would not change your plans for the future. You would not have to take your children out of college. You would not have to work longer years than you expected to, beyond your planned retirement date, or anything of this sort, because it is money you can afford to lose. Now, what I want to do today to start with is to discuss the variable portfolio. Last week we talked about the permanent portfolio, so this week let's talk about speculating. Because not only do I think it's a good idea that if you want to beat the market, you should do it with a separate portfolio, so many people who are following my general approach to the market will have a variable portfolio, but also because practically everybody in the market is really using just a variable portfolio. Most people who invest are looking to beat the market. They don't know anything about investing. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're mechanics, they are bookkeepers, they are clerks, they are all sorts of things, salesmen, whatever. But when they go into the investment world, they think they can beat the market. They think they can do better than other people in the market, even though they have no special training, they have not recognized any special talent in themselves, but they still believe that somehow they're going to get in there and they're going to do better than others if they just read the right books, if they just subscribe to the right newsletters, if they just exercise the right judgment, if they just spend enough time at the computer, data mining, looking for indicators, looking for this, looking for that, if they just attend enough investment conferences. Of course, it never works out well, but the point I'm trying to make is that since most people are trying to beat the market, and since even if you do set up a conservative, diversified, balanced, permanent portfolio, you may want to have a second portfolio in which you try to beat the market. Since these things exist, we should talk about the principles of speculating, of how one does beat the market. And I'm not going to give you guaranteed tips. I'm not going to acquaint you with a trading system that is infallible. I'm not going to acquaint you with any of these things. But what I am going to talk about are some general principles about how the markets work, so that if you are going to attempt to beat the market, maybe you won't just walk into a pit. Maybe you won't fall down a trap door. Maybe you won't get snared by some of the common errors that people make when they try to beat the market. So after we take a short break for a few words from some sponsors, what we will do is go into those principles, and I welcome your questions. You can call me at 1-800-259-9231, 1-800-259-9231, or send me an email, question@harrybrown.org. We will be back in just a couple of minutes. Well, welcome back. This is Harry Brown, and this is The Money Show for Sunday afternoon, August 22nd, 2004. And before we go ahead with the principles of speculating, let's take a call from Paul in Virginia. I don't like to keep people waiting on the phone, so let's see what's on Paul's mind. Good afternoon, Paul.
Hi, Mr. Brown. I downloaded, purchased, and bought your Failsafe book this morning. And I have a question about the variable portfolio and real estate.
Sure.
You mentioned in there that real estate can be quite a number of things in the variable concept. And I have a feeling that every homeowner might already be set up with a variable portfolio of a speculative nature due to the real estate bubble that everybody's been into the past couple of years. And I'm wondering if you have some ideas on different ways that people might approach this.
All right. Let me first bring other listeners up to speed on what I have said about real estate in the book Fail-Safe Investing, which you're referring to. I said there that real estate is not an investment as we think of investments. If you buy a stock or a bond or gold or some other commodity or foreign currency, you can look in the Wall Street Journal every day and find out exactly what the value of your investment is. You can't do that with real estate. If you suddenly decide you want to sell some of your stocks, bonds, gold, whatever, you can just call a broker and the sale is made immediately. You can't do that with real estate. You may take a month, 2 months, 3 months to sell your home or other real estate property, whatever it may be, and then when you sell it, you have to wait maybe 30 days during an escrow in order to get your money before you can use it elsewhere. When you sell a stock or a bond or commodity, you get the money immediately at the moment, really, that you tell the broker to sell, and the money is available for something else. So real estate is not an investment as we think of investments. So what is real estate? In what I have said is that it can be one of several things. Number one, and what it is for most people, is a consumption item. You buy your own home because you would rather own your home than to rent a home. You have more control when you own the home. You know you can always stay there. If you have a 2-year lease, you don't have to worry that at the end of the 2-year lease, the landlord is going to sell the property or whatever it may be. In the process of owning your own home, the home may appreciate, and you may actually make a profit when you sell it, but then you probably will buy a home of equal value, which has also gone up in price, so you really haven't gained anything as you move from home to home, generally speaking. Now, so number one is that real estate for most people is a consumption item. Secondly, it can be a business. People go into the business of buying and selling, and they spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week at it. They know what they're doing. They have scouted out all the locations. They have done many, many things that a part-time speculator can't do. When you read that you can make vast money in real estate, what you're reading is that by spending 5 hours a week or whatever it may be on some real estate speculating, you can do as well or better than people who spend their whole lives fooling around with real estate. It's a business for people, and that's a legitimate business, like buying and selling furniture or being in some other retail business. And lastly, real estate can be a speculation, part of the variable portfolio, in the sense that you think some particular area is going to boom in value, so you buy property. You're buying an illiquid item that you cannot sell at a moment's notice, but still you think it is worth it over a period of time to speculate in it. Now, coming back to Paul's question, he's saying that many homeowners think that they're going to make money on their real estate, but we may be in a real estate bubble that's going to pop. Well, if you own your own home and that's all, there really is no reason to worry about that, because if prices go down on real estate, if they were cut in half, which is not likely, but if you had the extreme situation that they were cut in half and you decided that you had to move to another city to get a job or do something else and sell this home, you would probably find that when you buy another house in another city or another part of the city in which you live now, whatever it is, the prices there would have gone down by 50% as well. And so you really are not losing anything in the same sense that you're not gaining that much when prices go up, because when you finally sell the house to go move in another house, that other house has appreciated or depreciated the same as yours. Now, the only time it really makes a difference is when you decide to retire. And maybe then, for the rest of your life, your children are gone, everything else, you and your spouse may decide that you're just going to move into an apartment for the rest of your life. Well, in that sense, then any profit that you've made on your home will be important to you. And if you're approaching that situation now, then the possibility that real estate prices might suddenly plummet downward would be of concern to you. Paul, am I helping to shed any light on this?
Yes, I mean, it's important that the house I bought 5 years ago has already doubled, and, you know, I'm looking at it to see if I can put my 9-year-old through college, but my 9-year-old college horizon is a long ways away, and there's a long time away until we could possibly use any kind of home sale, and in the meantime, you know, it would make me kind of nervous just sitting around on an unrealized gain that I couldn't really do anything with. I'm more tempted to just put it into some kind of variable portfolio to capture the gain.
You mean go ahead and sell the sell your home and use the proceeds to do other things with it? Well, here's the way you can look at that. Go through a little mental exercise. Number one, assume you've sold your home and try to put a value on it. Obviously, you don't know what price you can get for it, but you probably have some general idea by what other houses have sold in the neighborhood, and a real estate agent or broker could certainly fill you in if you don't have some idea yourself. But get some general idea of what it is likely that your house would go for. How much equity would you then take out of this sale? And then secondly, what would you do with that? Would you move into another home? Well, there again, ask yourself, what are you likely to spend on another home? And how much of the equity that you've taken out of your home will you then have to put in the other home? Maybe you will be able to buy a second home with a smaller down payment than what you have taken out of the first home. In that case, you will have extra money available to take care of your son's college when it comes up, or some other needs, or just to speculate with it. And we'll continue with this little exercise when we come back from this break, so stay tuned. This is Harry Brown. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Welcome back. Harry Brown here, and we're talking with Paul in Virginia about one's own home as a real estate investment, but which is really a speculation if you're thinking of having a home in order to make money. And I said that if you're wondering what to do about the home, whether to sell it or whatever, the first thing to do is to ask yourself how much you think you can get for it realistically and what that would mean in terms of equity. In other words, how much cash would you take out of it? And then secondly, what would you do with that cash if you were to buy another home? Would you need to use all of that cash for the down payment? If not, or if you were not going to buy another home, whatever cash is available then, what would you do with it? And would it be more valuable to you than staying in the home that you're in now? All right, Paul, where are we then?
Well, the real estate question is
do I think there's a bubble?
there's really not a blend available there. I mean, I've attempted to blend it this year to have both it be a consumption item, just live in it, but have it also
make money.
Take some of the future gains and, you know, realize them now. What I actually did was I I took a home equity loan and I put it in PRPFX, the permanent portfolio.
So you refinanced the home, is that it, or took a second mortgage?
A home equity loan and put it into the permanent portfolio fund, and I that made me feel better to not wait until some, you know, future date 10 years down the road, because we don't really have any intention of selling the house because we like living here.
Sure. Well, you've answered the question not only for yourself but for other people. You've made a very good point there that what you have done is to act on what you feel. You feel uneasy about the real estate market, so you've taken some of your profit out. That doesn't mean you won't take a loss or see the price go down of your home, but you've pulled some of the money out and put it in other things that would do better if real estate were to fall. And that way, not only are you protected, but you feel protected. And that's very, very important. It's important not just to do what you think right, but will make you feel right, because otherwise you're just going to spend every day worrying about whether the real estate market's going to fall. Now that you have done something about it, you're not going to worry about it so much. You're going to hear something on television about this, that, and the other thing, which to you would lead perhaps to lower real estate prices, and it's not going to cause a great big feeling in the pit of your stomach because you've already done something to protect yourself, and that's very, very important.
You know, I feel a lot better than I did in March and April when houses were selling in an hour or 2 hours at the most.
Yeah, right.
You
mean that they would go on the market and then be off in an hour or 2 hours?
Yes. Also, I missed last week's program, so I didn't hear your comments on PRPFX. Is that in the stocks area or of the four categories?
PRPFX, which Paul is referring to, is the symbol for the Permanent Portfolio Fund, which is a mutual fund that enables you to have a permanent portfolio without having to set it up yourself. What I described last week was setting up your own permanent portfolio split four ways between stocks, bonds, gold, and cash. And you also can invest in the permanent portfolio fund, which is a mutual fund that does something similar. It has a permanent portfolio. It doesn't try to time the market. It is there to try to protect your savings, whether we have prosperity, inflation, deflation, or recession. And it's especially good for people who don't have enough money to set up a four-way portfolio on their own, which you can do with as little as $4,000, but at $10,000 it works a lot more fluidly. But if you have even $1,000, you can put it in the Permanent Portfolio Fund. And the Permanent Portfolio Fund is on the Radio Links page of my website at harrybrown.org. What I mean is that a link to it is on there so that you can get more information about it if you like. And your question was, where does it fit in the Permanent Portfolio? It is the Permanent Portfolio. So it isn't one or the other of the categories. It is the portfolio itself. Paul, thanks so much for your call. I appreciate
it. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. All right, let's talk a little about speculating before I get to some email questions that are quite interesting. And the most important thing to understand about speculating, trying to beat the market, is what it is you're actually trying to do. And many years ago, in a galaxy far, far away, when I was giving an economics course, I defined a successful speculator as someone who buys something when nobody else wants it and sells it when everybody else does want it. And that really is the essence of speculation. And if you buy something when nobody else wants it, you are also buying it when nobody thinks it has any value. When other speculators or would-be speculators are thinking, well, that's a stupid investment. And when you sell it, you are selling it not only when everybody else wants it, but when everybody else thinks it has great value. And other people are saying, you're selling this? This is the hottest thing in the market. Why are you selling this? That's stupid. In other words, if you're a speculator and you're going to do well, you've got to assume that people are going to think you're stupid. Of course, people may not even know what you're doing, but you can divine in reading newsletters and looking at investment shows on television and so on that people don't think very much of what you're doing. In other words, if they knew that you were buying this particular item, they would probably tell you you really are pretty dumb. And if you were selling right now when this thing is hot and they're talking about how hot it is on television, they would think you were pretty dumb. Let's take an example. For example, oil right now is somewhere around $45 a barrel. I didn't check the price at the end of the week, but it's in the $40 range somewhere. Let's say $45 a barrel. Now, everybody knows that oil is really in a scarce situation right now. Half the Iraqi oil supply apparently was blown up by resistors to that wonderful American occupation over there that is making a free country out of a country by occupying it. Well, wait a second. Don't try to figure out the logic of that. But you get the point that Iraqi oil has been cut. And Iraq was at one point the second largest oil supplier in the world. Not only that, but we're hearing a lot about the resources drying up, that Saudi Arabia doesn't have the oil reserves that they once had, and so on. So what does this make as far as oil for the future is concerned? It sounds very promising for the price of oil. Well, let's look at that when we come back from this break. This is Harry Brown. The phone number is 1-800-259-9231. I will be right back. Hello again, Harry Brown here, and this is the Money Show on the Genesis Network. And before we went to the break, we were talking about the price of oil, the fact that it's now in the 40s, and the general talk around the world on television, in newspapers, in newsletters, and other places is that the oil supply is drying up and that we are running out of the world's reserves of oil, and we are in a precarious situation. And, of course, the logical conclusion to be drawn from that is that the price of oil should go up. Well, here's a newsflash. The price of oil has gone up. The price of oil in the 1980s fell to as low as $10 a barrel. And I haven't looked it up today, but it seems to me it may have even broken under $10. And if anybody knows that, let me know. But it was certainly down to $10 a barrel after being in the 30s during the 1970s. So at $45 a barrel, the price of oil has already quadrupled from where it was 20 years ago. And so how high could it go? Well, it could certainly go higher than it is now. It might go into the 50s. It might even go into the 60s. It's not likely to go to $100 or $200 a barrel because one thing is being overlooked, and that is as oil gets scarce and the price goes up, people start looking for oil and drilling for oil in places where it was not economical to do so at $20 a barrel. And so more oil tends to come on the market when the price goes up simply because it is now profitable to drill. Now, this is true in any commodity. It's true with gold or silver or copper or tin or anything else, that there is always a big supply of marginal reserves somewhere that just aren't worth it at the current price. But when the price goes up by 20, 50, 100%, then those marginal reserves become profitable and the miners start taking them out of the ground. So the same thing is true with oil. My point is that while oil is possibly going to go higher from where it is now, it is very unlikely to double. It could, but it's unlikely. But how low could it go? It could drop down to $30 a barrel, $20 a barrel. If somebody comes on the market with a whole new set of reserves of oil, if Saudi Arabia suddenly says, well, you know, we're going to start digging or drilling for the really marginal reserves and so on, if the Iraqi situation settles down, I mean, all kinds of things that can happen, and there is no absolute reason that the price of oil can't go back down to $10 a barrel at some point. Maybe it isn't likely, but what I'm saying is you have a huge downside risk and not that big an upside potential. Why? Because betting on the price of oil now would be betting on what everybody else believes is the proper thing to do. And I say everybody else, that's hyperbole. I'm exaggerating. Not everybody believes it's a good thing to do, but you get my point. It's the majority opinion. And so what you have to do to be a successful speculator is you have to buy things that don't look smart to buy at this time. And you have to be willing to sell at a time when other people think this is the time to be buying or at least holding because this is such a hot investment. Well, we'll talk more about speculation in coming programs. Let me take a few questions here. Greg in Portland says, regarding your advice for the bond portion of the permanent portfolio, you currently recommend the 6.25% Treasury bond of May 2030, but what does an investor do 10 years from now when you recommended that you trade in the bond for another one? Well, what I said was you should have the longest bond possible because it's the most powerful one, and the longest one now is available. That's available matures in 2031. So when it gets down to 20 years to maturity, it's not so powerful anymore, so you should trade it for the longest bond available again. And the same thing is true for you, Greg, that when your bond gets to the point that it only has 20 years to maturity, which I guess would be in 2010, you just simply buy the longest bond that's available then. And I think certainly the Treasury will have bonds available at that point that go well beyond 2030. Dave says that there's a continuous race going on. On the one hand, technology is striving to advance and do more with less resources, which would seem to create a deflationary trend, that is, prices going down. But on the other hand, Federal Reserve management of the economy and the money supply seem to create a continuous inflationary trend. It seems that the Fed is winning since we have a continuous upward sloping inflationary trend since the Fed was created. But can we conclude that with the tendency of the innovative free market to produce cheaper and better products, our technology dividend of what should be much lower prices is being stolen by the Fed's inflationary actions? And with technology advancing in leaps and bounds, this gives the Fed even more leeway to print money and issue debt without the normal disastrous level of inflation that would result. In other words, the Fed is inflating the economy by printing more money, and technology is helping to soften that by finding ways to lower prices. The most dramatic example we see in the computer industry, where prices are so much lower than they were 20 years ago. Well, let's answer that question when we come back in just a minute. This is Harry Brown. Don't go away. We've still got another segment to go. I'll be right back. Well, I really would like to leave that music playing so we could dance a little longer, but I think we better get back to the business at hand. And before we went to the break, I was addressing Dave's question, which is, with technology working to lower prices, as we see in the computer industry and VCRs and a lot of the electronics industry, and on the other hand, the Fed working to increase prices by flooding the country with paper money, is one hurting the other, or is the lowering of prices by technology enabling the Fed to print more money without disastrous consequences, or what's going on here? Well, what we have to understand is that it is a fallacy to believe that technology is lowering prices in general. It is not. It is lowering the prices of specific things. And if you lower the prices of specific things, what you do is you give people more money to use elsewhere, where they will use it and push prices upward by their purchases of other things. Lowering prices in one area just simply frees up money to buy other things. And that has no effect on the general price level, then. It all works itself out. What has effect on the general price level is money and money alone. But it isn't just the supply of money, it is also the demand for money. And this is a very important point that needs to be understood. Inflation occurs when the supply of money rises faster than the demand for money is rising. Or it occurs when the demand for money is dropping faster than the supply of money is dropping. Now, what is the demand for money? It is the desire of individuals to hold money, metaphorically to keep it in their pocket, rather than investing or spending it because they're concerned about the future. And if the demand for money rises, then it soaks up the supply of money that the Fed is printing. And it thereby neutralizes the opportunity for that supply of money to cause inflation. And that's what we've seen in recent years, is that even though the Fed has been flooding the country with money, people are worried because of 9/11, because of all the things the government is doing and so forth. They're worried and they're not investing and spending all that money. A lot of it is just being kept in bank accounts or in other places where it has no effect upon the price level. In other words, a lot of the money that the Fed is printing is getting soaked up by the demand for money, and so we're seeing a relatively low inflation rate. If the demand for money changes, if people start loosening up and spending and investing more, then all this money that the Fed has printed may start leading to inflation rates of 5, 7, 10%, who knows what. That could happen tomorrow, that could happen next year, that might not happen for 5 years. I don't know. But on that note, we're going to say goodbye. I hope you'll come back again next week, because we're going to do this again. So come back, sweet papa. I said it, come back. This is Harry Brown. Have a good week.